to that aid. Thank you so much. Minister, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and may I then continue where we had left off earlier, which is to appreciate the opportunity to address the committee, and I'd indicated that this is the last scheduled engagement on the detailed content of the bill, and I do appreciate the opportunity. I'd also like to say that I've been asked specifically to talk through the amendments that the committee has put forward in the form of the A-list. And by way of reference to documentation, we have the bill itself that was introduced in Parliament, which is B-23. The A-list, which is amendments that came through the portfolio committee process, it's B-23A. I also understand that the staff of the committee and the parliamentary legal advisor has kindly put together what is an informal document that consolidates into B23 all the changes that have been effected, including the changes in the A-list. We've also submitted from the department on the 16th of September a report to the committee, and we're tabling today, dated the 2nd of October, a response by the Ministry to the proposals contained in the A-list. So let me start, Chairperson, by saying that I really appreciate what I think has been an excellent piece of work by Parliament's legal advisers and the state law advisor that captured the discussions that we've had as the executive with the portfolio committee. And before I move on to the content, if I may ask that our appreciation for the work, the technical work that was done, be recorded. Chairperson, I'm going to use essentially the document called Response from Economic Development Ministry to the Portfolio Committee, and that's the document dated the 2nd of October. It is not my intention to spend a significant amount of time summarizing the changes that the committee had agreed to last week or 2 weeks ago, but to the extent that there's a need for us to elaborate on any of the content, underlying content of the issues, I would be quite happy to do so. So, Chair, I'd start by saying the bill, the Competition Amendment Bill, was introduced in Parliament on the 11th of July, and the committee kindly provided an opportunity for a detailed engagement and for us to be able to explain the rationale for the bill in some detail. Following public hearings by the committee and discussions within the portfolio committee, I was given a further opportunity to engage the committee on the substance of the public hearings, the concerns members of the public had raised, the support that members had indicated for the bill, changes that members had members of the public had sought, and questions posed to us by members of the portfolio committee. Based on those discussions, on the 16th of September, we then provided the committee with explanations for the point of view taken by the executive. We identified some options where the committee had more than one possible way to go forward. And in some instances, we provided potential wording where appropriate. Following the clause-by-clause deliberation by the portfolio committee, the ministry was furnished with a copy of the A-list by the Parliament's legal advisor and the state law advisor reflecting the proposed amendments to the bill introduced to Parliament. We've considered the A-list, and this is what I understand today, Chairperson, you've asked us to comment on. And we've tested the A-list against the original purposes of the bill and the discussions that we've had with the Portfolio Committee previously. We've also conducted a review of the clauses of the bill to ensure that the cross-references were full, complete, and accurate. I should indicate at this start that we're in agreement with the amendments proposed in the A-list. So that's the big conclusion out of the discussion. In the review of language, there are a few areas that we may want to get the committee to reflect on options and possibilities to the committee. They're in only one area that affects two sections of the bill. And in another area, we have picked up some cross-references that should be changed, cross-references to other clauses. They're really of a technical nature, and that would then constitute the way in which we're going to deal with it. So essentially, we're comfortable with the A-list and with these relatively focused and small suggestions, the executive would be comfortable from our side, and then of course leave it to the committee to deliberate and reflect further. I should indicate that the references in our document refers to the clauses of the Competition Amendment Bill, and because the A-list does not systematically change everything in the bill, we only refer to those areas where changes are contemplated. So you'll see the clauses are not full and complete. There are some that are not referred to for that reason. If I may start with Clause 1, which deals with the definitions, there's a change to average avoidable cost that has been introduced in the bill. And from the Ministry's side, we support the change that has been made. It does not materially change what was in the bill, but it does have the effect, helpfully, from our point of view, of clarifying with greater precision what is intended with the bill. Secondly, there is a change to the definition for margin squeeze, and again, we've consulted, and honourable members will know the older story of Lyndon B. Johnson, the American president. This is one of those stories that has been retold many times, and sometimes the identities of the presidents change. And he went to his chief of staff one day, and he said, "Mr. Chief of Staff, please find me a one-armed economist." And the chief of staff looked at him very surprised. This is not in the current age where chiefs of staff are no longer capable of being surprised with the current incumbent, but I am on the record, so I should simply stay with the Lyndon B. Johnson story. And he asked him, "Mr. President, why a one-armed economist?" And he says, "You know, the problem with my economists are, when I ask them for advice, they say, on the one hand, Mr. President, and on the other hand." Now, the definition of margin squeeze is just a slight improvement. It removes ambiguities, and I can go into the merit of it, but we're comfortable with the approach taken by the committee on both definitions. Clause 3 deals with Section 4 of the Competition Act, and that's the restrictive horizontal practices. And the essential change that has been made here is that the committee elected, instead of guidelines issued by the Commission, to have regulations made by the Minister, and the motivation, as I understand it, from the committee, among others, is that the Commission acts as a investigative, almost prosecutorial agency, and it should therefore not make the rules. And the committee, as I understand it, was also concerned by the implication of a recent constitutional court judgment that may impact on the use of guidelines. We're comfortable with the approach taken by the committee. It affects a few sections of the bill. For the information of the portfolio committee, we advise that the ministry is in the process of constituting a material advisory panel, which will provide advice on regulations which must be published by the Minister in terms of Section 4, 5, 8 and 9, so that the Ministry is able to rely on expertise in this area. It doesn't require any change to the bill, but it's for the information of the committee. dealing with Clause 4, that's the one that relates to Section 5 of the Competition Act, that's restrictive vertical practices. These are between customers and suppliers in a relationship. Point 1 of list A document prepared by the A list document prepared by Parliament replaces the use of guidelines with regulations, and the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. Point 1 clarifies that the excessive price provisions apply to both end consumers and industrial customers. The Ministry supports the proposed change. Points 2, 3, 4, and 5 essentially reflect the deletion of the buyer power provisions in Clause 81D 7 of the bill. The amended provisions on buyer power have now been included in a standalone Section 8.4. The Ministry is in agreement with the proposed changes. We think it, in fact, improves the reading of the bill. It brings all the provisions tightly together, and through the parliamentary process, it leads to a better piece of legislation. Point 6 reflects the inclusion of a materiality threshold, the test of reasonableness that should be applied in respect of excessive pricing. And while we took the view that courts in any event would always read reasonableness into the application of legislation, we were in agreement with the proposal by the Portfolio Committee that this be made an explicit test in the bill. So we're happy with the proposed changes. Point 7 replaces the use of guidelines with regulations, and we support that proposed change in the section. Point 8 introduces a new subsection 8.4 dealing with buyer power, and it reflects the discussion in the Portfolio Committee as well as the engagement with the executive. We're in agreement with the proposed inclusion as formulated by Parliament's legal advisers. We've also been advised that the new wording proposed by the Portfolio Committee will enable regulations to be made, setting out factors and benchmarks to determine firms owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons who should be covered by subsection 8.4.D.2. Now, before going on with the report, let me just briefly introduce this verbally and then go back to the text. In the old version of the bill, the Minister retained wide powers in terms of Section 78 to make regulations to give effect to the purposes of the Act. And the Commission had the opportunity to issue guidelines in terms of Section 4, 5, 8, and 9. In Sections 8 and 9, both the Ministry and later Parliament put in place strong protections for SMMEs and for firms owned and controlled by historically disadvantaged persons. Now, an SMME, or SME is defined in the bill, and there are thresholds set for an SME based on turnover, employment, those kind of things, and the Minister is given the power to do that. Historically disadvantaged persons is defined, but what one of the issues that's come up is what do we do some years from now, because we're not just writing legislation for 2 years or 4 years. What do we do some years from now when a historically disadvantaged, a firm owned by a historically disadvantaged person is also a dominant firm? Would they then continue to be able to rely on these provisions? Now, the bill as it was originally drafted, in our view, gave the Minister wide powers to issue regulations that could have covered this. The bill as it's now formulated, in our view, acting on legal advice, still gives the Minister that right. But in discussion between two different sets of persons, one drawn from the judiciary and the other one drawn from the legal profession, the advice we got from our lawyers was no change is necessary. The advice we got from the judiciary, it's always better just to be explicit. It just avoids unnecessary litigation down the line. So essentially what we want to do is to ensure that some years from now, when we're in the position where firms owned and controlled by historically disadvantaged persons are in fact dominant firms, that they can't at that point rely on the protections that are intended to be given to smaller firms. So that's the problematic. Okay. How could we deal with it? The advice we got is the language in the bill and in the A list is sufficient. However, if Parliament wants to do belt and braces just to make absolutely certain that down the line someone doesn't challenge the exercise of public power, then Parliament may wish to consider a small amendment to make it more explicit. I'll go through the detail. We'll leave that to the committee to take a view on the matter, and from a ministry point of view, we would be comfortable with either approach. So having explained it verbally, let me go back to the text. So we say in the text, it is for the information of the portfolio committee, it is noted that it's the intention of the minister to effect regulations setting out the size of firms owned by historically disadvantaged persons, perhaps based on market share, turnover, or employment, to which the section applies, to ensure that a firm that is both an HDI firm and a dominant firm does not unfairly access the rights contained in the section. So that we then say that portfolio committee may wish to consider whether, for the avoidance of doubt, it is necessary to explicitly provide for this matter to be addressed through regulation. Should this be the approach of the portfolio committee, a change would need to be effected to subsection 84D as follows, and the text in red is the possible change. So the text currently reads as follows. The minister must, in terms of section 78, make regulations designating the sectors to which the subsection will apply and setting out the relevant factors and benchmarks in those sectors for determining whether prices and other trading conditions contemplated in paragraph A are unfair. That's the current language. So just to recall, our lawyers say, using that current language, the ministry is entitled to issue regulations on size of HDPs. However, it is possible that an HDP may in future take the matter on the review and say, well, if Parliament really wanted to give that power, it would have made it a bit more explicit, because it explicitly, unlike the current Act where Parliament doesn't bound the Minister, doesn't specify, it just gives the Minister wide powers in Section 78, now it begins to identify in these sections what the Minister must do, which is appropriate, there's nothing wrong with it. But in this case, the courts may say, well, if it was Parliament's intention, why didn't Parliament say it? So if Parliament wants to go, if the Portfolio Committee wants to go the other route of making it explicit, then the language could read something like, and I'm sure the parliamentary legal advisers could improve the language and made it more elegant, but something like, the minister must, in terms of Section 78, make regulations designating the sectors, and in respect of firms owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons, the benchmarks for determining the firms to which this subsection will apply. So you could make a regulation saying, excluding an HDI, HDP, that is a dominant firm, or you could put some numbers to it. That's the only possible change, and again, I know I'm emphasizing this point. The advice we've got are two different bits of advice. One lawyer says, it's fine as it is. The other says, well, why not just protect yourself and the exercise of this necessary power by making it more explicit? And the issue arises because we've shifted from guidelines to regulations, and so we must make it a little bit more explicit. It's really a minor change. It will come up twice. I'll draw attention to it comes again, and that's perhaps the only substantial point we want to make in the entire discussion on the A-list. Clause 6, which deals with price discrimination, that's regulated currently in Section 9 of the Competition Act. Points 1 and 2 clarify that the provisions for price discrimination deal with a dominant firm as a seller. As buying power has now been included in a standalone Section 8.4, the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. It makes sense to us. Point 3 reintroduces the test of substantially as the threshold, as the hurdle that must be cleared for a price discrimination matter to be successful against dominant firms. And honourable members will recall this was a concern that some of the large corporates had. And complementing that is a new test for price discrimination relating to SMMEs and historically disadvantaged persons. The Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. We think it's helped to make the intervention, the policy intervention, more targeted, more specific, and it avoids the spillover effects to large firms. Point 4 introduces an anti-avoidance clause for dominant firms who avoid dealing with SMEs and firms owned and controlled by historically disadvantaged persons. In order to circumvent the operation of the section, the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. Point 4 also amends subsection 9.2 to enable appropriate referencing of the amendments to targeted sections, and the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. This change, though it's a technical one, it really just splits up the provisions into subsections so that it's easier reference, but it's an essential change if one wants to reintroduce substantially in 9.1. So it's a necessary change to enable 9.1 to be given effect to. Point 5 proposes a consequential renumbering of provisions. We agree with that. Point 6 deletes the current 9.3 and 9.4 in the bill, and it does so because Section 9.3 provision has now been reformulated in a new 9.3. And 9.4, which deals with buyer power, has now been included in the standalone 8.4, making it redundant, unnecessary, and the Ministry is thus in agreement with the proposed change. With both changes, in fact. Point 6 also introduces a new Section 9.3 and 9.3 capital A, which deals with the onus on dominant firms when there's prima facie evidence of either price discrimination against an SME or a firm owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons, or a refusal to sell to such firms to avoid operation of the section. The Ministry is in agreement with the proposed changes. They're really a requirement in the light of the representations made to the committee, both by some of the larger corporates, Vodacom stands out, as well as some of the other interveners. The Ministry has been advised that the new wording proposed by the Peace Portfolio Committee will enable us to make regulations, setting out the factors and benchmarks to determine which HDP firms are covered by subsection 9.4b, similar to what I've just taken the committee through in section 8. The committee could either leave it as it is, but if the committee for the avoidance of doubt wants to just tighten it a little bit, there is a formulation that we've put forward, which includes the words under subsection 4, the Minister must make regulations in terms of section 78 to give effect to this section, including the benchmarks for determining the application of this section to firms owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons. So the same motivation, same thinking as in section 8. Moving next to clause 7, which deals with the exemption provisions in Section 10 of the Competition Act. Point 1 clarifies that an exemption may be granted if the agreement or practice promotes either the effective entry participation in or expansion in the market, and we in agreement with the proposed change. Honourable members will recall previously it said and it was based on the court giving it a robust definition or interpretation that all three states won't apply simultaneously, and so therefore they are in the alternate. And the committee decided, let's not leave it to jurisprudence, let's just make it explicit, and the ministry supports the approach by the portfolio committee. Point 2 clarifies that a new section, which is section 1010 in the bill, which is a section, honourable members will recall, where the minister is entitled to make regulations regarding exemptions of a category of agreements or practices, as well as an agreement or practice. Following the discussion by the committee, the ministry is comfortable to narrow the focus of 1010 more clearly to what was intended, and therefore delete the reference to single agreement or practice. That language is in the European Union guidelines, but we think in the South African context and given the architecture of our Act, it reads better to remove the singular and keep it as categories of agreements or practices. So in short, we support the approach by the Portfolio Committee. Turning next to Clause 9, which deals with consideration of mergers, Point 1 reflects simply an error in the bill introduced to Parliament, in that it refers to Act 39 of 2009 instead of Act 39 of 2000, and we in agreement with the proposed change. Point 2 clarifies that when the Commission considers a merger, or if the Tribunal considers a merger, they must also consider the impact of the merger on the effective entry, participation in, or expansion in the market. So it's the same point, whether the word and can be read to also imply the word or, whether we make it explicit. We like the approach of the Portfolio Committee, so we support the proposed change to make it or. Clause 10, which deals with the revocation of merger approval and the enforcement of merger conditions. Honourable members will recall that one member of the committee asked the question to us whether, in fact, Section 15 is not potentially too wide in its framing. Based on that, we went back and we had accepted in the committee that there's grounds to tighten it a little bit. And the amendment clarifies the grounds on which the Commission may make any appropriate decision in terms of merger conditions relating to employment and the ability of SMEs and HDPs to effectively enter into participate in or expand within the market, and so we are in agreement with the proposed change. Clause 11, dealing with the mirror image of that clause as it relates to the Competition Tribunal, same change, and the Ministry supports that change. The new Clause 13, which deals with Section 18, intervention in merger proceedings, it clarifies that the Minister may participate in mergers in order to make representations in public interest matters, and we in agreement with that change. The old Clause 13, which deals with the new Section 18A, that's the intervention in merger proceedings involving foreign acquiring firms. There are a few changes that the committee has made to this area in the original bill. We support all of the changes the committee has made. We think it addresses some of the concerns that has been raised by members of the public in the public submissions. And in any event, it makes for a better application of the section. It will give it a greater ease of implementation. Point 1 in the committee's A-list substitutes the word important with the word critical. So we've taken out the word important and we've put in the word critical in subsection 18A4D. When I say we, I mean Parliament's legal advisor and the portfolio committee, and that's been put to the ministry. The ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. It speaks to one of the submissions made by members of the public. Point 2 and point 3 provide for notification of mergers to the Section 18A committee to be simultaneous at the same time as notification of the commission. Now, honourable members will recall, in the original bill that the department submitted to Parliament, we saw a sequential process. We first complete a process involving the national security veto, and then we commence a process from there involving competition issues. Based on the public representations, the discussion in the committee, and the engagement between the committee and the executive, we are in agreement with the proposed change that these processes be simultaneous. That would then mean that potentially mergers would be considered on a more expeditious basis than set out in the bill. So we support the proposed change. Point 4 reflects a grammatical error in the bill, and we also don't think grammar error should be perpetuated, so we support the proposed change. Point 5 now sets out a statutory period of 30 days in which the minister must publish the decision in the Gazette. This is a decision of the Section 18A Committee and inform Parliament. The ministry is in agreement with the proposal by the Portfolio Committee. Point 6 clarifies that the Commission and Tribunal may not consider a merger which should be notified to the Section 18A Committee until the committee has been notified. The ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. Point 7 introduces a new subsection 18A13 that provides for grounds for the committee to revoke any approval or conditional approval of a merger, including through failure to commit to notify the committee, or if the approval was based on incorrect information, if the approval was obtained by deceit, or if a firm has breached any obligation attached to the approval. It further clarifies that if the committee revokes its approval, the commission and tribunal approval is deemed to be revoked. So that's a package of measures that the Portfolio Committee has put in place to ensure more effective implementation and certainty on the consequences of either failure to notify or provision of incorrect information or deceit, and the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed changes. Point 7 also introduces a new subsection 18A14. It clarifies that the tribunal may impose a penalty for any implementation of a merger without appropriate approval or for failure to notify consistent with the provision of other mergers in the Act. In other words, the requirement to notify the Section 18A Committee now has the same status as the requirement to notify the Commission of a merger. We support the proposed change. Point 7 further renumbers the old subsection 12, such as consequential changes are then effected. We are in agreement with the renumbering changes. Clause 21, which deals with competition tribunal proceedings, there's a drafting error in the bill referencing the incorrect paragraph. We're in agreement with the proposed change that corrects that. Clause 23 on initiating and conducting market inquiries. Honourable members will recall that point 1 amends the period in which an aggrieved person may appeal any determination of the Commission regarding confidential information. The committee had previously proposed that the executive gives thought to a proposed change from 10 days to 15 days. We've come back to the committee. Committee and supported the committee's proposal. However, following the review of the language in the bill, it's also recommended that the Portfolio Committee makes a further amendment in subsection 43B, 3 capital AD, to ensure that the appropriate cross-reference to relevant subsections be reflected in the bill, and we draw attention in the text in red what that change would be. It would read this subsection as opposed to subsections 1 and 2. And following a similar review of 43B1A, we've also proposed that the section ends as subject to subsections 2 to 6, not 2 to 7. Clause 25, which covers a number of areas dealing with market inquiries, point 1 clarifies that the tribunal has the power to make an appropriate order in respect of divestiture once it has received a recommendation from the Commission in terms of subsection 43D2. And really what Parliament's legal advisors have said is that though it may be implied, it's always better in legislation to make these things explicit. We think there's wisdom in that advice, and we support the approach of the Portfolio Committee in making that amendment. Point 2 amends a spelling error in the title, and we're in agreement with the proposed change. Point 3 clarifies that SMEs falling within the scope of a market inquiry may also participate in such market inquiry. We are in agreement with the proposed change. Point 4 provides for the Commission to take reasonable steps to promote the participation of SMEs at the market inquiry, and the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. So there are two changes, both dealing with small and medium enterprises, and I think it gives effect to the will of the committee that we strengthen the small business provisions in the market inquiry, and as that in any event is also the purpose of the bill, one of the purposes of the bill, the executive is very supportive of the approach of the Portfolio Committee. Clause 32, oh, I should just indicate, Chair, it's also an area that came up from small businesses in the submissions to Parliament. Clause 32, which deals with administrative penalties, point 1 clarifies that abuse of buyer power is a prohibited act which can attract a penalty. This is a consequential change from the inclusion of the buyer power provision in a new subsection 8.4. Previously, it was in 8.1d, which covered a series of prohibited practices. Now that it's a standalone provision, the committee is absolutely right, and Parliament's legal advisor is absolutely right, that for the avoidance of doubt, we should specifically indicate that it is a species of prohibited act. So the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. Point 2 clarifies that refusal to deal with SMEs in order to circumvent price discrimination provisions is a prohibited act which can attract a penalty. This is a consequential change from the inclusion of the anti-avoidance clause in Section 9, Section 8 and 9 really, and the Ministry is in agreement with the proposed change. The next area is Clause 34, dealing with appellate jurisdiction. Point 1 introduces a provision which clarifies that the Tribunal and Competition Appeal Court do not have jurisdiction over matters in Section 18A, dealing with national security, except in respect of penalties which the Tribunal may levy for failure to notify. We are in agreement with the proposed change. The new Clause 39, which deals with regulations, point 1 amends the section on regulation, providing that when making regulation referred to in Sections 4, 5, 8, and 9, the Minister will in future be required to consult with the Commission and publish a notice in the Gazette allowing for public comment. The Ministry is in agreement with the proposed changes. As indicated earlier, we advise that the Ministry is in the process of constituting a ministerial advisory panel which will provide guidance on the regulations which must be published by the Minister. I just again, by way of information to the committee, in passing makes the point there is merit in the setting up of a standing advisory committee. And we're considering this. No changes would be required in the bill to give effect to it, but it could strengthen governance and ensure that this and future ministers are given proper advice by suitably qualified persons in the crafting of regulations. New Clause 45, which deals with the arrangements of sections in the Act to take account of the provisions in the bill. We have no specific comment on the proposals in the A-list. We support the broad approach by the Parliamentary Legal Advisor and State Law Advisor will leave it to the advisory, the legal advisory team to finalize the proposals in that area, but to the extent that the committee, the portfolio committee, has supported that approach, we too support that approach. So that, in short, Chairperson, I have gone relatively quickly without explaining and providing context in every instance to the what has been conveyed to us as the discussions in the portfolio committee previously, but I hope this gives a sense. So in summary, we support the changes contemplated in the A-list. We have raised in two sections an issue around potentially just tightening the wording to deal with the regulatory power in respect of historically disadvantaged persons, and we have corrected a few cross-references to ensure that they're full and complete. Chairperson, as I've indicated, I'm available to provide a bit more context to the thinking, but I would like to conclude the initial presentation with a word of thanks to the Portfolio Committee also for the enormous amount of public representations that the committee was able to deal with in both in detail but also within a time frame that has enabled us to be here today. So I would make a concluding comment, Chair, once we have completed the discussion today, to convey my thanks to the committee, but that concludes our initial submission on the A-list. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Minister, for your responses to the work that this committee has done, has already done on the bill as tabled and proposed by yourselves, and also the new proposals that you have made afterwards. We really appreciate the fact that we are on the same level of understanding, since we are all public servants and we're serving the same public and constituencies. May I now use the opportunity to open up for any questions, any comments? Remember, we are only dealing with the responses as put by the minister or as presented by the minister with respect to the amendments made by this portfolio committee in our last meeting. That's the process matter that we are in now. May I see members who want to speak by a show of hands? Dr. Kado?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Minister.
Is that all? Okay. Dr. Kairo.
Thank you. Just three things to kick off with, Minister. First of all is the change from guidelines to regulations. I'd be interested to hear some of the background thinking that took place that's led you to agree with a wholesale shift from guidelines to regulations. I mean, there's always a danger with regulations that it concentrates too much power in the hands of the line minister. I'm curious to know how your standing advisory committee would work and what examples can be drawn from equivalent type committees in other jurisdictions. But in essence, some further exploration of pitfalls of shifting from guidelines to regulations. Secondly, I raised the matter of characterization in Section 4 at our last engagement, and I know you were open to that. Has there been any further thinking around the inclusion of characterization in the legislation? And then thirdly, on the subject of buyer power, if you could walk me through some of the discussions that took place, at least in the Ministry's response to the suggestion that the buyer power provision should be consolidated in this new standalone subsection 8.4. I think the point that I raised last time was that there was a danger that buyer power provisions could result in upward pressure on consumer pricing, and I also drew attention to some of the suggestions made in the Genesis submission around about a code of conduct to address concerns around buyer provision, buyer power, which are primarily public interest in nature and relate to trading terms, not price levels. Was any further thought given to such a code of conduct? That's it for the time being. Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Kairo. It's quite interesting that you're not asking the, because we are not in that meeting, the reasons behind the committee's suggesting what we recommend, what we suggested as a form of an amendment.
I would have loved to have been in that meeting if you'd been more flexible around timing, Chair.
Yeah, because this was really discussed at length. We spent a lot of time discussing this. But anyway, I'll allow that the minister respond to that, because you're asking now the minister's response. I mean, the reasons behind this was is agreeing to our amendment. Yeah. May I then give the opportunity to Minister, you'll note the three. I take it that you noted the three questions, and now I'll give the opportunity to Dr. Tlhiane.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. We think it is proper to thank the Minister for the manner in which he has responded to the changes that we as the committee have proposed. We note the attitude of the minister is not to oppose what Parliament or the committee has suggested, and what he suggests, for instance, in the strengthening of some of the sections as they regard to the previously disadvantaged people, makes some sense. But I think the legal team will assist us as far as that is concerned. Maybe on the issue of the regulations, Chair, we can indicate as the committee that we're of the view that there is a lot of ambiguity around guidelines, which can be interpreted in a variety of ways. We then decided as the committee that we should opt for regulations, which are very specific, and they don't leave a lot of room, for confusion. And on the issue, Chairperson, finally, of the Standing Advisory Committee, our view as a committee is that this advisory committee is there to serve a purpose, not necessarily the minister. So the ministers may change and so on, but the committee is there to serve a purpose. It's a committee of experts. It will continually give that a particular advice that it is designed to give. So we just want to appreciate the attitude of the Minister Chair, and we think the legal team will just assist us where it is recommended that perhaps we need to strengthen here and there. But over and above that, Chair, we appreciate the fact that our views have been taken into consideration by the Minister. I thank you.
Thank you so much, Ndati Tlene. Any other hand? Minister, the opportunity to respond.
Well, first, thank you very much, Chairperson, and may I then start with the questions put by Honourable Cardo. Thank you, Dr. Cardo. On the guidelines versus regulations, perhaps I can just briefly recall the background before turning to the substance of the issues. When during the period when the bill was originally drafted, the Ministry looked at international practice and found that both guidelines as well as regulations were used in different jurisdictions across the world. In some cases, the competition authorities issue guidelines. In other instances, executive authorities issue regulations. And in one instance, which is the European Union example, there is resort to both. There are some advantages to guidelines. The main advantage is flexibility, that you can issue them and change them relatively quickly. And they would typically be issued by the Competition Commission. And the Commission would have access to quite a bit of detailed information because they work on a day-to-day basis with the bill, or the Competition Act, rather. So that's the critical advantage. The advantage, the disadvantage of guidelines is what is their legal status, that they are certainly not binding on the Commission itself, potentially, nor are they binding on any of the further processes of the Tribunal or the Competition Appeal Court. The advantage of regulations is that there is more precedent in our law on the use of regulations. Many acts of Parliament have provisions for regulations to be issued by ministers, and so there's a rich jurisprudence about under what circumstances can ministers issue regulations, how are those regulations bounded, and there's clarity in the market on the role of regulations. But there's one other significant matter, and that is the ministry has no direct role in sections 4, 5, 8, and 9. And that is material in part because of a judgment that came out. It's known as the Marshall Judgment, and in this one, the Constitutional Court examined the role of the practice notes issued by the South African Revenue Service. So it's similar to a guideline that a Competition Commission would issue. And the Constitutional Court held, that I want to quote, they asked the question, why should the unilateral practice of one part of the executive arm of government play a role in the determination of the reasonable meaning to be given to a statutory provision? They then say, the courts go further and they say, it might conceivably be justified where the practice is evidence of an impartial application of a custom recognized by all concerned, but not where the practice is unilaterally established by one of the litigating parties. So they took issue with the fact that SARS issues a practice note and then SARS also litigates against the taxpayer and it uses that practice note as a basis in part for its litigation. So our view as the ministry is when this matter came up in the committee on, I think it was the 11th of September, we were flexible either way. We said we'll go with the view of the committee, whether it's guidelines or regulations. We pointed out the advantages of both. The committee then took the decision that it would prefer regulations, and the committee will no doubt, members of the committee will no doubt speak with more authority and more eloquently than I can. But as I understand it, the committee took the decision for the following reasons. One, the committee reflected that this constitutional court judgment was quite recent. It was issued, in fact, in April this year. And therefore, to the extent that it raises challenges with guidelines or practice notes, it would be more appropriate to stick to tried and tested areas of subsidiary legislation in the form of regulation. Two, as I understand it, the committee chose regulation because the minister has no statutory role in section 4, 5, 8 or 9, which are the four sections where the regulations apply. It can't, so to speak, prosecute, it can't litigate in those areas. The litigants would be the Competition Commission, as well as individual firms that are affected by the practices. The Minister's role is in respect of mergers, which is a different section of the Act. And to avoid the perception of a potential conflict of interest between the Commission as the issuer of the guidelines, and the Commission in taking forward what I call in quotes prosecuting, it's not a technical prosecution, but taking forward the investigation and setting out its case to the tribunal, as I understand it, the committee wanted to avoid that. So both for legal certainty and to avoid any potential conflict of interest, the committee, the portfolio committee, took that decision. Coming now to the question whether this could potentially provide too much power in the hands of the executive, I point out that Section 78 of the current Competition Act provides the minister with wide powers to issue regulations to give effect to the purposes of the Act. So this would not provide the minister with greater powers than are set out in Section 78. All it would do is it would require the minister, it's basically an instruction from Parliament through the legislation, that the minister must issue regulations, whereas at the moment it's within the discretion of the minister to issue any regulation that the minister may deem necessary. Parliament has now set in these four areas we want the minister to utilize the power set out in Section 78, and honourable members will see that in each of these areas there is a reference to both Section 78 and in Section 78. We then took one step further, because we're trying to draw to ensure that Parliament has the best advice from the executive when it changes the law, that we're writing the law not for individuals, we're writing it for the long term. So what we've done is we've then gone, Honourable Cardo, to Section 78, and we've tightened Section 78 itself. So the minister still retains the power to make regulation, but we've now said that before the minister can make regulations in these sections 4, 5, 8, and 9, the minister must consult the Competition Commission. And then we go further and we say the minister must also publish a notice in the Gazette stating that draft regulations have been prepared, specifying where a copy of the draft regulations may be obtained, invite inviting members of the public to submit written comments on the draft regulations within a reasonable period. And then the minister is required to consider any comments submitted within the period contemplated before the minister may finalize the regulations. So, Honourable Carter, it could well be, I think a compelling case can be made that this is a constraining of executive power, not an expansion of executive power, that is currently unbounded other than by the guidelines that the courts have put in place for the issuing of regulations. It's now specifically bounded by these requirements, which are good requirements. They help to improve governance, and accordingly, I think you will look at this as a whole, you'll see that it's not an increase of executive power, but it's a sharpening of the provisions the Competition Act that the minister will be required in future to make regulations. On the Standing Advisory Committee, the question that Honourable Carter asked is there precedent for something like this elsewhere? In most other countries where, in fact, there is power to regulate, there would typically not be a Standing Advisory Committee. In fact, ministers have the discretion to set up a panel at any given point and either take their advice or not take their advice. We think it's good governance that when you deal with technically complex matters, that you in fact seek the advice of appropriately qualified persons in doing so. We're not asking for a change in statute. That's within the remit of Section 78 in the normal exercise of ministerial power to set up committees. But there is an interesting example, Honourable Cardo, that is not exactly what we seek to replicate, but to the extent that one wants to draw analogies, the Davis Advisory Committee on Tax Matters has served a number of different ministers of finance, Judge President Dennis Davis, who is not only the head of the Competition Appeal Court, but is also the head of the Tax Court. He has served to advise Minister Gordon when he was Minister of Finance, and then Minister Nene, and then Minister Gigaba, and then Minister Nene again. So it's been multiple ministers that have benefited from that. So by analogy, it brings that kind of experience and expertise to whoever may hold the position of minister at any given point. So that's really a little bit of the thinking. So I think you'll find, Honourable Cardo, that taken as a whole, that the ideas and thoughts we have in this area is to ensure an appropriate exercise of public power, and we're bounding that public power in the ways that we're envisaging, not expanding it. On characterization, this matter came up in a meeting of the committee, which essentially was the question, did the executive consider putting a characterization test in the bill? Now, honourable members would no doubt recall that I briefly explained what the characterization test was. And essentially what the characterization test was is a provision in the law that indicates whether a set of practices in fact fall within the boundary of prohibited practice. Now, you've got two options in any society now to deal with it. It is a matter that can be dealt with either by the judiciary through the development of jurisprudence, and in fact, the characterization test has a significant history in South Africa in court judgments, or you could codify it into your law. We gave some careful consideration. It took quite a bit of discussion at NEDLAC. And in the end, we believe, having heard everybody, having heard the business community, organized labor, the Competition Commission, which had strong views on it, the legal advisors from all of the different parties, we came to the conclusion that introducing a characterization test in the competition amendment bill was inappropriate, that there were risks attached to endless litigation on whether in fact a species of practices fell in or outside of the ambit of the Act. And we took a different approach. The approach we took was to issue a degree of certainty in the market, either through guidelines, as we originally contemplated, or regulations now, as is provided for in the bill, together with a greater level of precision in the language that we brought to bear in some sections of the bill, and then very importantly, perhaps the most important part of the package as the alternative to characterization, was to expand grounds for exemption. Previously, exemption, if you wanted to be granted an exemption, let's say you do something and you think it's not against the law, it's in the national interest, you took that on risk. Now we've given the Competition Commission wider scope within which to provide a company or set of companies with an exemption for practices that may otherwise be prohibited. So we've put together an alternative package in the NEDLAC discussion that doesn't go the road of characterization, and having reflected on it, we feel it is the better approach, and we've got substantially more consensus on the road that we've selected among practitioners than had we gone the route of characterization. It would have certainly ended up with less consensus. Finally, on the buying power issues that Honorable Cardo raised, let me also recall the context of this issue. In our law at the moment, we provide for the category of prohibited practices or abuse of dominance practices where a supplier has inordinate market power, very substantial market power, and where it meets the test that it's a dominant firm. So that's classic what they call monopoly provisions. But in economics, there's another problem. And that's the problem where a buyer, not a seller of a good, but a buyer of a good, has very significant power. And the seller of the good does not have as much power. In an example like that, the imbalance of market power can lead to abuses. And so we've made provision for that by putting in place a provision that deals with that imbalance in market power between buyers and sellers. Now, why would we not simply replicate it in exactly the same way as we deal with all other prohibited practices? The reason for it goes to the issue Honorable Cardo raised. When you have very high levels of market power as a buyer, some of that may benefit the public through lower prices. If a large buyer, let's say a large retailer, keeps the price pressure on all of their suppliers, and if they pass that on to the final user, consumers get the benefit of lower prices. However, there are two problems with it. The first problem is a retailer, I'm using retail as an example, it need not only be a retailer, by the way, but a retailer may not pass all of that benefit on to the final user. So they may, in the language of economics, they may capture that benefit for themselves. You see it often in the construction industry. Large contractors employ many smaller subcontractors. So the large contractor has the buyer power. They're buying the services of smaller contractors. But even though they drive the prices very low for the small contractors, they don't always pass that on with a more competitive price to the final user. So it's what they call the problem of capture. Not state capture in this case, but it's a problem who captures the surplus in any economic transaction. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is in traditional economics, where you have a very competitive market, you look at consumer welfare as a key element, and in some competition jurisdictions, they put most of the focus on consumer welfare. What countries like South Korea and others have done is they've said that competition must bring a balance between consumer welfare and producer welfare. You don't want the cheapest goods for consumers, but all of it is imported from abroad, because then you hollow out your manufacturing base, you don't have manufacturing jobs. In the long run, consumers are worse off because, yes, in theory they've got low prices, but in practice they've got no income. And so it's finding that balance that South Korea began to champion. In our own Competition Act, which is 20 years ago, Parliament in its wisdom did something very important. It drafted an Act of Parliament that explicitly seeks to balance the interests of all participants in a value chain: consumers, workers, producers. So our Competition Act, the entire architecture of our Act, is based on that careful balance. But when you go, so that's in the preamble, and it's in the philosophy of the Act. Once you go into the substantive provisions of the Act, Section 4, 5, 8, and 9, which deals with various forms of prohibited practice, unfortunately, there's no corresponding draw through. That vision set out in the preamble isn't carried out in the operating section. So we're simply rectifying that by explicitly providing for buyer power. So that's the rationale. Now, Honorable Cardo raised previously in the committee the idea that one could give consideration, for example, to codes of conduct. And it's one that I am supportive of. I think it can play a very useful role, and we've seen in the United Kingdom example, in fact we've just had the head of the Competition Commission in the United Kingdom visiting South Africa, I think about a week ago, and I had the opportunity of spending a few minutes with him talking through their experience with the regulatory environment in the United Kingdom. So they have provided in some of their remedies for codes of conduct. We think as we have crafted the bill, codes of conduct can still play a role. They could, for example, arise from a market inquiry. In a version of the bill that we looked at, we also, in fact, developed language that tried to give effect to that experience. It's not one that we ultimately put forward. It would have required quite a few changes in the legislation to give effect to it, but it's one that we were not unsympathetic to. Now let me go to the final part of this, which is how did we get to where we are on buyer power, the consolidation in 8.4. The committee itself, in an earlier discussion, raised a concern, as we understood it, as it was communicated to me, that the buyer power provision that we had put in 8.1d7, Roman 7, that was in the old bill, It was fine, but it had a problem. The problem was that it only applied to dominant firms, and secondly, it provided a clear defense by dominant firms, what they call the pro-competitive gain defense. And the committee, as I understood it, was more in favor of a provision on buyer power being available to any firm, and that it should not only arise from the conduct of dominant firms. And the committee's concern, as I understand it, arose from the difficulty in always being able to establish that a firm is a dominant firm. And as I understand the chairperson, I was not present, the committee looked at the retail sector, and it said it had something like five or so large players in the retail sector, none of whom met the statutory presumptive threshold of 35% market share. But nonetheless, it's clear that in the retail sector, there is concern by committee members about practices involving access of smaller players to those stores on terms that are reasonable. So that was the problematic that was put to me. In our submission to the committee in September, we outlined two possible roads that the committee could take. And we gave up the one that we preferred. So the one road was to delete the reference to buyer power in Section 8 and 9 completely and incorporate it in Section 5 of the Competition Act. The effect of that would mean that the buyer power provision would not only apply to dominant firms, it would apply to all firms. So if a large firm that was not a dominant firm had a degree of buyer power, then and exercised that buyer power in an exclusionary way, then potentially the SMME or the Competition Commission could litigate on that matter. So that was a very clear and simple solution. However, there was a problem with it. The problem was that we would extend that protection to cover many, many more instances, because now you would cover dominant firms as well as large firms. And the effect of that potentially could be that the Competition Commission could be swamped with complaints about the abuse of buyer power. Because buyer power don't only affect retailers. It's right through a value chain. There's always buying and selling. If you're going to make this bottle of water, then the people who make the plastic bottle, they are buyers of polymer, PET, that is used for the manufacture of this bottle. And then the people who bottle this would buy the empty plastic bottles from them and would fill it with water. So they would again now become buyers of the product. So right through a supply chain, you have numerous buyers. You don't only have the final interface with consumers. So we were very concerned that we did not want to open the floodgates, and we were open with Parliament. We said, this is a road Parliament can go, and we even provided possible language, but the challenge we see is that it can significantly expand the remit. We tried to mitigate that. We said, you could provide for the Minister to designate specific sectors that are supplied to narrow the scope somewhat, but it still remains potentially, even within the narrowed scope, it would cover many different kinds of firms. Finally, our concern was that if a large firm that's not a dominant firm abuses its power, a small player can go to a competitor. But if you have a dominant firm, you basically may not have an effective competitor. So are we not interfering in the market mechanism unduly if we shift all of this to Section 5? So those were the considerations we had in mind at the time. So let's call that Road 1. And the Ministry said, if Parliament was to go that route, we would not be opposed to it, but we see a number of problems in that route. Alternatively, we said we could stay with Section 8, remove it from 81D7, make it a standalone section, and then delete the reference to to buyer power in 9.4. It would then simplify the application of the buyer power provision. It would make it clear that it still only applies to dominant firms, the conduct by dominant firms, but it would ensure that dominant firms are not able to rely so easily on the defense that is set out in 8.1D, the defense of pro-competitive gain. So in all of this, Honorable Carter, what we've tried to do is to carefully balance it so that the courts, when they interpret whether in fact you're abusing buyer power, will take all of this into account, and they will be able to determine in a given set of circumstances whether a dominant player has abused that market power. And in all of this, the key issue for us is whether that buyer power has a negative effect on the operation of small and medium enterprises and firms owned or controlled by historically disadvantaged persons. So I've gone a bit of time, I've gone right from the start, Chairperson, traced the issues carefully, because I think what the committee has done is come up with a balanced approach. The committee then in the end abandoned the approach of looking at Section 5. The committee then took the view that it wanted to concentrate buyer power provisions in Section 8, but it decided let it be a standalone clause. And I think it will give the market a better sense of the practicality of the clause. It will reduce somewhat the potential for the Commission to be flooded with matters that come before it. And the regulations gives an additional, quite critical, and this is why regulation is maybe more appropriate. It gives the regulation provides that the sectors would be, I'm just looking at the language, that the sectors to which the subsection applies will be designated in regulation. So instead of the entire economy being subjected to a large number of potential complaints, what one would look is, what's the available resources of the Competition Commission? Does it have 50 million rand available for this kind of investigation? 30 million. Then you designate sectors that enables practically the Commission to carry out its statutory mandate. That's the background to the buyer power provision. So, finally, on the code of conduct, that may still come out of a market inquiry. We were tempted to put it in as one of the things that the minister could do in the regulations, but we came to the conclusion that it would require changes to the architecture of the Act, because you'd need to, before you give a minister that kind of power, you'd have to say what process the minister goes through. You'd have to then indicate what is the consequence for non-adherence to such a code of conduct, and that would be very big changes in the bill. As it is, none of those would be necessary if it came via the market inquiry. So I hope that answers a little bit the balances we've tried to strike with this. Honorable Tliani, first, thank you very much for your very warm comments, and Parliament is ultimately the decider of the laws, and therefore the executive has to see where Parliament wants to go with an area, and unless the area could potentially be damaging from a public policy point of view, we want to work with this committee. This committee as in fact through the work of the committee, you as honourable members have significantly strengthened the legislation further. You've given effect to the concerns that were raised in the public submissions, and it's really been an honour to work with the committee on this bill. I will leave to the committee to make a final decision on the one change that we suggest may be helpful in respect of historically disadvantaged persons. But on the Standing Advisory Committee, it does not require any change to the legislation. It would be something that is already within the remit of the executive. It's just not been done. And it's not been done because there's not been a mandatory requirement in the law to date for the minister to issue regulations. It's been a facility. The minister can invoke it. It's been at the discretion of the executive. Parliament has now introduced a hard-working requirement that the executive don't only have the power, but that it is required to utilize that power to give greater clarity in the market. So now I think it's the right time for us to have the setting up of an advisory committee. And a standing advisory committee means that you build institutional memory so that you don't set up a panel each time you want to put in place a regulation. So I hope, Honourable Chair, that covers the issues raised by Honourable Kiani and Honourable Cardo. But this bill has, as I indicated, benefited very substantially from the guidance that the committee has offered. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Minister, for that clarity, and I'm happy that you did clarify, although I was tempted to really intervene during your response to Dr. Kado's questions, because I believe that committee meetings are meant for such clarities. And because we were really processing this bill and we felt that everybody needed to be here so that we can all put our heads together so that we ultimately can come up with a piece of legislation that will talk to the objects of this particular bill, objects which are intentions of this particular bill, of course. I just want to also remind members that the two main reasons behind coming up with this particular bill. One is to really deal with the economic concentration. Secondly, to be the skewed ownership of this the economy that we have. And for us to be able to do that, this is not the only way, but this is one, but the way of doing or of putting or inputting into dealing with that skewedness of this particular economy, skewedness in terms of distribution and also participation of our previously disadvantaged. I'm not sure whether there are any follow-up questions on this particular. I'm going to allow that because I want us to be as transparent and as honest as possible. And because we are representing our constituencies, and the fact that we had gone at length with the public participation process, and wouldn't want anybody to feel that he or she is left out in this whole process of dealing with this particular bill. So this is open now for those who feel they have a follow-up. So I'll start with Dr. Kadu, and then I'll come to Mr. Madele.
Thanks, Chair. I think it's worth noting that the meeting that you referred to was called at the 11th hour in a recess period, and that there were a number of members present here today who weren't there.
It's not true.
Also, it's worth noting that this is a long history.
It's not true, Dr. Kaido. No, I'm not going to allow you to do that first when you are distorting the facts. Before we left, when we were dealing with the program, we did allude to the fact that we were going to meet. It was not a rush issue, it was not a rush matter. We had agreed, you were in that meeting, when I announced that we're going to be having this process. I outlined the whole process map of this bill. And I even asked if there were any questions. There were no questions. So I don't want you to distort the facts. The fact that you were not in that meeting, because the dates were there, they were very clear. Because you asked the question also afterwards, and I explained it to you. Because you personally asked me, and I explained that to you. And you said, okay. The fact that you were not there, it was taken. But the fact that you are now going to use that as an excuse, the wrong facts as an excuse, I'm not going to take it. I think you are now really doing the wrong thing. And I think you must correct yourself.
I've got no intention to correct you my version. That is my version. I stand by it. We have a very different recollection of events. The fact is that we've given inadequate consideration to this bill. It's had a very long genesis of the NEDLAC process, but we've rushed through it in the parliamentary process. That is the fact.
Well, let it remain your vision. Your version.
Well, the true vision.
Okay.
Anyway, on to my question. Minister, regarding the new clause 13 on section 18 on intervention in merger proceedings, why should it be that a minister has the power to intervene in mergers on public interest grounds at all levels? I mean, surely effective regulation thrives on clear and predictable institutional rules and administrative processes, and isn't there a danger in taking away some of that which is in the rightful domain of the competition authorities and giving it to the minister by allowing the minister, whoever that minister is, not necessarily yourself, but whoever comes after you, to be involved in mergers at all levels? I mean, doesn't this open up the space for backroom deals between individuals? Doesn't it undermine clear, transparent, predictable rules? So that's the one thing on intervention in merger proceedings. The other is Section 15.1b, which I raised at our last engagement in terms of what it meant for the Competition Commission's powers in merger
contracts. Dr. Kaido, you are now abusing this particular process. I want us to focus ourselves on what the Minister was responding to today. There are only two. I was actually going to move. I said those who have follow-ups to your questions, and that's definitely not a follow-up to what the Minister responded to in relation to the questions you posed. No, I didn't say general discussion. We did process that. We did process, and then we came up.
That's an abuse of your power.
You had an opportunity to be present.
Yes,
you opted not to be present.
I cannot pop out you, it's the same way that you restrict during the engagement with the
minister. And the meeting continued. I didn't come back to question what happened. No.
Clarification on an item of legislation.
No, you had that. You can't divert us from the focus that we are in now.
Well, this is very Stalinist, Chair.
No, it's not. We want to make progress, and this is the progress that
you're
we're going to make.
You're acting in an extremely authoritarian fashion. Our job as legislators
say
is to ask
is fine, but
about
unfortunately, I'm sitting at this chair at the moment.
Mr.
Klein, come in, please.
Well, Chairperson, the unity and integrity of this committee is paramount. We are aware, as Chairperson, that we may be coming from diverse backgrounds, but we've always worked as a team here. And we respect one another. We respect the Chair, and the Chair respects us. We don't think it is correct, Chair, for our Honourable Dr. Karu to create an impression here that, you know, some people are being disadvantaged and so on. That is not true. We think it's not possible for all of us to be in meetings, in all the meetings. Sometimes we are unable to come, but we understand the basic rules of meetings. If I'm unable to attend for whatever reason, when I come back, mine is to observe what the team agreed upon and not try to undo it, you see. So we value the input that Dr. Kado always make, and we want him to be part of the processes because some of his ideas assist us also, you know, to make progress going forward. But we think in this particular instance, he is pushing his luck unnecessarily, and we respect him. We respect his views, and we respect his party. We think, let us avoid taking that route. We are not at war with each other. We are here to help one another to do what is best for our people. So we think, you know, he should not be allowed to proceed in that fashion where he harms his own integrity. We want to continue respecting him all the way until this process is completed, Chairperson. So we think that as far as the presentation that has been made today by the Minister, the questions that were raised from the response were responded to. We can't take him back to the previous meeting. It will also be undermining the integrity of the Minister as well. So as a committee, as a team, we think that is not necessary. Would say the same thing even if the Minister was from the DA or from the EFF. Would say the same thing because we need to treat people the same way. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Tateke. And I think also the fact that we were able to deal with the issues he raised, the Minister didn't just respond to issues that were raised by any other party and leave out the issues that were raised by the DA. He responded during that meeting to all issues as raised in the meeting that I was not part of. We felt very sorry that Dr. Kado was not there, nor Mr. Atkinson was not there to deal with those issues. We took time. We had our legal people, the state law advisor. We even asked them to go into issues that were raised just for our own understanding. Instead of coming to us and asking what issues did you discuss or what type of responses, you know, were given and how did you approach that, he wants us to then, he asked questions to the Minister, the Minister responses. He wants us to go back to the very same issues that he raised that day and were responded by the Minister. It's unfair. We cannot, you know, rehash what happened in the previous meeting.
The documentation was sent at 5:30 p.m. last night. That's part of it.
No, I had the same. It was sent to Peter Paul on Friday. That's the truth. It was sent to Peter Paul on Friday, and it was sent to even myself. You are not the only person, even myself. But you had the whole week, plus the other week, to ask about the previous meeting. You did not do that, because you could have asked either Peter Paul to give you records of that meeting, or phone me or ask me so that I'm able to explain.
I mean, the phone process is an absolute sham, and I don't legitimize it, so thanks very much. I'm always very glad to engage with the Minister. He gives excellent answers to my questions, but if you won't allow me to ask the questions that I need to, then I won't legitimize the sham process.
I'm sorry then if you have that undermining spirit in yourself. It's okay. It's nothing new that you are doing. Thank you so much. Members, we have the presentation as made by the minister. Honorable I forgot, Honorable Madam. Sorry.
No, thank you, Chair. I appreciate that you have been completely sidetracked dealing with this particular matter. Chair, I also seek your indulgence, and where I'm out of order, please do so, rule me out. Honorable Minister, my question relates to two areas, the issue of buying power, economic concentration, and MAP. I'm just a bit worried, Chair. What kind of measures will then be in place if the whole issue of buying power is restricted to dominant firms and that large firms are literally, how could one say, given the green light to go away? Because my concern is that SMMEs, and especially HDPs, to what an extent will they be offer some protection from the large firms? Is there protection in place in relation to the dominant firms? I know you said earlier the concern that you have expressed to the committee is that the one approach of where both of them are targeted is will be opening up a big floodgate of potential complaints. But in the back of your mind, there must be some way that some protection could be offered, or the economy be more opened up to especially the small, medium enterprises and historically disadvantaged. On the issue of MAP, I also wish just the minister to clarify. My understanding is that the ministerial advisory panel would be put together, that you're in the process to deal, to give advice on the regulations. Now, I may be reading it, understood it wrongly, but I thought that means that they would advise you with regard to putting up, formalizing, finalizing the regulations. If that is the case, then it means it's a body that will exist only for a certain period of time. But I got the impression that you indicated also that this body should be more a permanent structure, Chair. I just wish that kind of clarification to be given. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mata. Minister, do you want to explain that?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Honourable Madela's question, on the standing committee, that's really just for the information of the committee. It's just for transparency. We're indicating our thinking. So that's within the normal remit. You can set up a longer-term committee, or you can set up a committee on a once-off basis. But because the committee has played such a key role, the portfolio committee, in thinking through competition challenges, we felt it may be helpful just to give an indication. So the advantage of a standing committee I've covered, which is that you build up expertise and knowledge, obviously that's of some significant benefit to any minister. On the other hand, sometimes you may not be able to get people who make a long-term commitment. They may be prepared to do things if the period that they are required to offer advice is 6 months or a year. So that's really the balancing that one would have to bring about. The second question that has been asked about buying power, I think there the challenge is in competition law, not just in South Africa, but across the world. There's a difference between consumer protection law and competition law. Consumer protection law helps any consumer against whoever they buy from. So it would help a small business against another small business. It would help a small business against a large business or against a dominant firm. That's consumer law. Competition law is different. Competition law wants to maintain the integrity of competition in an economy. And therefore, the focus of competition law across the world is on dominant firms. So competition law came out, its history is very interesting. It arose in the United States. And it became known not as competition law, that's a newer name. It became known as antitrust law. And it was when the American Parliament, their Congress, took action against companies like the Carnegie Corporation, a company called Standard Oil and others. These were massive companies in the United States. They were so massive that they distorted the entire system, the entire market. It wasn't that they were unfair towards an individual company only. They made the system not work for people. So that's the origin of competition law. So in a competition act, it's a careful balance that one can't make it a consumer act because that's a different part of the law with a different set of legal principles and a different set of practices. So we did look, the committee looked at length whether it shouldn't in fact extend the protection even to larger firms. But as I've indicated, the unintended consequences could make the competition authorities become like a consumer tribunal. And that would mean that they no longer regulate competition in the market, but they regulate conduct in the market. That's something very different. So there's still a role that I think in the design of our legal system to see, are we protecting smaller businesses as consumers adequately from unfair practices? But that doesn't fall within the remit of competition law. And the reason why we're trying to focus on the role of competition law is that a system must have integrity. That when you compare that system with systems elsewhere in the world, even if our one has, like other systems in the world don't look at historically disadvantaged persons. We can bring a concept in, there's nothing wrong, but we must do it within the architecture of a regulation of markets, competition. You don't begin to do it in the same way that you'd regulate labor law or consumer law. So let me take labor as an example. Employment is an issue in the competition law. Now the competition law won't look at the individual conduct of a manager as against an individual worker. It looks at whether a merger itself has a negative effect on labor relations. So I always go back to the purpose of competition law. That's maybe another way of putting what I've covered earlier. So I think that covers these areas, Chairperson. And I would be in your hands if you'd like me to make any further remarks on the other questions that came up.
Unfortunately, no, Minister. I think we did that work in our last meeting at length, and we're not going to revisit that. Mr. Madela, do you have a follow-up question? Okay. Thank you so much. What's left, unfortunately, needs a quorum in terms of the issues that the Minister proposed on this particular, in his response to our amendment. And because we do not have a quorum at the moment, I don't know, the secretary and our legal advice will have to come in. We started with a quorum. I don't know what the working out means. before maybe I get that advice, can I give to Ntate Tlhiane?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There is a thing called filibustering, Chairperson, which a person can engage into if they don't want progress to be made in government. This process is a very crucial process, a legislative process. I think we need to look at this thing very differently. Some of us sense that there was going to be a possibility that what happened was going to happen as a way of trying to frustrate the process. Now, I think, Chairperson, because this is in the best interest of our people, of the general public out there, I think if we had a quorum when we started and we need to adopt what we've agreed on, I think there should be space for us to look at this matter differently. If we can allow this to happen from time to time, people will go into long sessions with us. At the crucial moment, they will then walk out. Then it means that they would be frustrating the work of government. I think let's look at all the regulations and consult and so on, but my view is that we should complete this process and we'll cross that bridge when we reach it, if there will be questions about the quorum, I think.
I wish it was that easy. That didn't plan. Hence, I'm asking in terms of our rules, and so that, because here we're dealing with a piece of legislation. I really concur with the sentiments that if things were okay, we would just continue. But because of this very crucial process, it might not be as easy as that. Are you coming back? Okay. Let's hear what the legal advice says. While they're still consulting minister and colleagues, there's one journalist, an a publisher, a writer, is of Portuguese origin. I think you are aware, you know the person, José Saramago. He once said, it is economic power that determines political power. And governments become the political functionaries of economic power. And that it is true. If really we're going to let go of that power, because I had the question, do you want the power centralized in your office? I know you answered that question very well, but what is important is that if you don't exercise that power, then you are also going to be compromising on that political power. That's my view. Because in as far as I'm concerned, you are definitely one of the functionaries of that economic power. And this legislation is in the right direction of making sure that we exercise that power in order to change the lives of ordinary people, especially the previously disadvantaged. What is the advice legally?
Thank you, Chair. I think in terms of the rules of the National Assembly, Rule 162, Chair, sub-rule 1 says a committee at all times requires at least one-third of its members to be present for it to conduct any business. In relation to making decisions, it says in terms of sub-rule 2, a majority of the members of the committee must be present for it to decide any question. So therefore, because we're taking the decision that is meant to be taken by the committee is an adoption, an approval of an A list, we cannot make that decision because we do not have a quorum currently. That is in terms of that. So therefore, what I would advise then, Chair, is either we postpone the meeting in order to get the necessary numbers in order to make the decision, to take a decision to adopt the A list.
Thank you so much, Bulele, for that. Yes, that's why I said it's not as easy as that, that it can. We were not as yet on the actual A list, but dealing with the amendments as brought by the minister, which of course are going to add into the A list. So because of the said rule or rules, we cannot therefore proceed. We have to postpone the meeting until we have the necessary quorum. The deadline, and then I'll give the minutes.
Chairperson, we accept the explanation, the legal explanation. Those are the rules, which may be changed in the future, of course, because they run contrary to the revolution that we are waging. But it's a topic for another day. I suggest, Chair, if it is possible, to allow the Secretariat to get in touch with our members who could not come for those reasons today, so that we check if they cannot be able to come down on Thursday. On Thursday, while we are still here in Cape Town. If they are able to come down and we get that quorum, then we finish this episode so that other processes can then unfold in days and weeks to come. That's what I would like to propose.
Okay. I just also want to put on record before the minister comes in that you see, as the chair, I really tried my best to be accommodative to everyone and to make this process as accepted by everyone when we started, to be as transparent and as inclusive as possible. But we need not to forget that we are operating in a very political terrain where we are now. And we are approaching elections. And people are going to use this particular terrain for their own benefits. I don't think we need to be discouraged, because ours here is a purposeful presence to ensure that we change the lives of our people for the better. And we are going to do everything in our that's possible and within our power to do so, to come up with legislation that are going to change or to impact positively in the lives of our people. This is a very necessary legislation that really talks to the core of our political emancipation, which is economic emancipation. If we really don't do that, if we don't take out our people out of the bondage of poverty, inequality, and deprivation, political power is as much as nothing to them. So we really need to do as much as we can. And really, no words or no action will stop us from doing that. I take it that we must really call on, we'll talk to the powers be that those who are available, really they must come and do their constitutional duty of being here and doing their legislative work. Why are they members if they can't do that? I think we try to be as accommodative as possible. But if people choose not to be part of meetings, if you are not part of a meeting, it's a standing rule, and it's a anywhere, whether you are in the private sector or anywhere, if you are not part of a meeting, you ask, what was the meeting all about? Or you know what the meeting was all about, what was the outcome of that meeting? Or if you you intend not to be there, and you are honestly intending not to be there because of honest circumstances, you give an input, you send input so that your inputs can be considered in that meeting where you're not going to be part of that meeting. So I take it that we've tried our best to to be as accommodative as possible. But if people have their own agenda, then we cannot help them, unfortunately. Would have loved to be as inclusive as possible, to have everybody here, so that we can, at the end of our work, say we have done what we were called here to do. It's just a pity that this happened today, which other frustrations could not happen, but this was the last resort. And there's nothing we can do. It's just that it's unfortunate that they had to take that decision, the DA specifically. Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, I just wondered, in the light of the advice by Parliament's legal advisor, if we don't separate out two issues. The first issue is the meeting of the committee. And my understanding is that the committee is currently quorate. It is able to proceed with the agenda item, which is ministerial response, and you can conclude that in due course, and that part of the meeting would then be concluded. Separate to that is the item on the agenda of the committee, which deal with the adoption of the report, the A-list. That item would then be affected by the level of attendance, but that's the next item. It's not the current item. The current item that you have not yet formally closed is the ministerial response. I would suggest, Chairperson, that it may be subject to your advice, that it may be appropriate just before concluding the first item, if we had a very short adjournment, just a short break in the proceedings, whereafter you could then call us back, we could then conclude this item on the agenda, and you can then advise how you wish to proceed with the rest of the meeting.
Okay. I'll take your latter advice, but and I will actually park what I was going to say now. But the reason I called for legal advice is because it talks to issues of quorum. It talks about the present, members present. I had thought perhaps it would talk to the members, the forming of a quorum during a meeting. Maybe we need to dig into the first issue that you raised, because your responses, Minister, talks to the A-list issues that we discussed in our last meeting. And these are issues related to the amendments as put by the members. And I say, as I earlier said, if agreed to, they are going to form part of the A-list. Maybe we need to break, yes, and take the minister's suggestion before we conclude the meeting, and then come back to further deal with the advice as we had been given. There's tea outside that has been ready for quite some time. I know it's time. They removed it. Oh my gosh. I'm not sure whether we should, because it's time for lunch now. Should we go break for lunch and then come back? Will it be okay with you, Minister? Because otherwise we had only we thought the tea was outside, they removed it. But we can still have a comfort break of about 3 minutes or so, if because I heard you saying you have another meeting.
Yeah, class, yeah, 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock, and it's already 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay, can you give us 10 minutes of your time? And then in that 10 minutes, 5 minutes will be for the comfort break, and 5 minutes will be for the conclusion. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.